Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling and you're listening to Bristol's first podcast, Dialect, at our Friday afternoon 2 o'clock slot on BCFM 93.2. This week, one of the people behind the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, Ken Keeble, lives in Somerset and he joins me. This week also, disabled rights campaigner Jason Yannakopoulos looks at the new Black Triangle campaign. And US filmmaker Alan Frankovich, who died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1994. Dialect is produced by volunteers and broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 every Friday afternoon. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. And the phone number's 0117 989 7733. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number's 01454 318 753. And we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. But first, I'm joined by Ken Keeble. Ken, welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
Give us an idea how you personally got involved in the struggle against apartheid.
Well, after the Rivonia trial of 1964, when Nelson Mandela and most of the leaders of the African National Congress were jailed for life, all the remaining members virtually all had to go into exile, and they had a problem then of how to carry on the struggle inside South Africa to prove to people that the struggle was not over, that the ANC was not defeated.
Tell us and about that trial. Can you just remind us when what it was about and when it happened?
Well, it finished in 1964. As I say, it lasted a long time. I forget how many people were involved, a large number. They'd all been arrested at the Rivonia farm just outside Johannesburg, where they were beginning to plan the armed struggle, having failed after many years with peaceful struggle in South Africa. All peaceful options have been closed to them, and they were met only with violence, so they had to turn to violence, and this was the trial.
Well, one can understand why any government would be rather worried about people who were meeting to start an armed struggle against them.
Well, indeed, but they've been committing violence against their own population for many, many years. That was their only form of struggle, almost, and it was only with great difficulty and a lot of heart-searching and great hesitation that the African National Congress turned to armed struggle after finding no alternative. They were not up against a democratic government. They were up against a government which denied the vast majority of its people the right to vote. So it was not a legitimate government in any sense. Anyway, the way I became involved was a small ANC group based in London hit upon the idea of recruiting white non-South African people who had no connection with South Africa, and they had various ways of doing this. Some of them were recruited at the London School of Economics, students who were engaged in a lot of left-wing activity at that time, but the main source of recruits for the ANC for this purpose was through the British Young Communist League. Now, I was born in 1945 into a communist family. Both my parents and most of my aunts and uncles were communists, and so I joined the Young Communist League at the age of 13, and in 1967, when I was 22 years old, I was approached by London District Secretary of the Young Communist League, George Bridges, and asked if I was willing to do something like this, to go to South Africa secretly to help the struggle there.
Okay, before you tell us about South Africa, what was the Young Communist League? Sounds a bit like the Cub Scouts or something. What actually was it all about?
I think the minimum age was 13, actually, or 14. I think I joined just before I was 14. Well, it was the youth wing of the Communist Party, and it was about fighting for socialism in Britain and worldwide, and in a struggle led by the working class to achieve a socialist Britain. And for me, because I was in a communist family, joining it was rather like a rite of passage, part of growing up. And so when I was approached, I'd already been in the YCL for quite a good many years, and when I was asked to do this in a very cautious way, My first thought was that I felt very honoured that I'd been asked. Very honoured I'd been selected for that task. And secondly, I felt that I was well suited for the job, that all my previous upbringing and study and experience, discussion of politics, had all prepared me for this sort of task.
So just talking about socialism, I mean, at the time, of course, back in, I suppose, the 1950s and 1960s, socialism was seen as something fairly normal because we'd had a socialist government, a Labour government, after World War II that had nationalised a fantastic amount of things. I mean, you know, various things like transport, things like they even were going to nationalise land, and then they decided to nationalise planning permission instead. So the permission to build was nationalised. What was the sort of? I mean, you say you wanted socialism, but what was the sort of the kernel of the politics behind the communists?
Well, the main idea is that instead of the capitalist class being the ruling class, the working class must become the ruling class. That's the main thing, that the state must, instead of acting on behalf of the super rich, as it does now, must act on behalf of the working class. That was the main thing.
I don't regard
the left-wing Labour government of 1945 onwards as socialist, and in the different meanings of the word socialist. It was left-wing, yes, it was better than we have now by a long way, but it didn't actually overthrow the rule of the capitalist class in Britain and replace it by the rule of the working class, and it sided with the United States in international affairs, which was its downfall, really.
What are your thoughts about? I mean, we will talk about South Africa, I promise you, in a minute. But you know, what's your thoughts about the way that the New Labour and the modern day kind of version of the Labour Party, which originally was a socialist ideal, and how that's developed now? Because we've got this situation with the super rich who are getting tax breaks and bankers, and yet people with nothing, and also people like the mentally ill and disabled people are being cut off from their benefits, or at least they're being pushed into a situation where they're supposed to be looking for work when there's less and less work around.
Well, the tragedy of New Labour is that really it adopted Thatcherite economic policies, basically. I mean, when Margaret Thatcher was asked what was your greatest achievement as Prime Minister, she replied, New Labour. And that's the tragedy of the Labour Party, and unfortunately the Labour Party now is still not, or at least its leadership is still not, broken away from that basically Thatcherite or Reaganomics approach, what was commonly called neoliberalism, in which everything has to be privatised, everything has to be driven by the profit motive, unions have to be very, very, very limited in what they're allowed to do, and so on, smashed if possible, and so on. That's the tragedy of the hole we're in now. We have three different political parties who are basically all wedded to the idea of neoliberalism or Thatcherism.
Okay, so tell us. Okay, let's go back to the 1960s again, and your mission, I suppose it was, and in your call, you were called to go to South Africa.
Yes, well, I went on two missions to South Africa. The first one was in 1968. I travelled to flew to Johannesburg. I'd never flown before. I flew to Johannesburg with a false-bottom suitcase containing 1,200 letters, which were addressed to members of the Indian community in South Africa.
How old were you?
I was 23 at that stage, just 23. I had to book into a hotel, buy 1,200 stamps, stick them on the letters, and post them at different places all around Johannesburg, so they weren't all in the same pillar box, so to speak, and then fly home. And nobody knew that I'd been, except the man who'd sent me there, which was Ronnie Casserels, who later became a minister in the post-apartheid government. He was responsible for the whole operation. Nobody else knew at all. None of my family, nobody. And my second mission was in 1970, when Ronnie asked me to recruit somebody to go with me, because it was two people, and I recruited my friend Pete Smith, who originally came from Southampton, also a member of the Young Communist League, and we went to Durban. And what we did there was we planted a number of devices called leaflet bombs, which were actually invented largely here in Bristol by Dr. Ron Press, along with others, but he played a big part in it. I'll tell you about Ron Press if you want to hear.
Well, yes, it'd be nice. Well, what is a leaflet bomb? Yeah, is it dangerous?
Not at all. Nobody was ever harmed by one of our leaflet bombs. One policeman who happened to be standing beside one when it went off got his uniform blackened slightly, but that's all. They weren't designed to harm anybody at all.
He's got a black uniform, hasn't he?
Well, he was a South African policeman. I don't know what uniform he had. But he might have had khaki shorts for all I know. I don't know. But anyway, No, it's Dr. Ron Press, who worked as a lecturer here in Bristol for many, many years, played a big part in designing and testing these leaflet bombs. In fact, he tested them on a bit of waste ground in Bristol and also took them out into the Somerset countryside to test there. He accidentally set fire to a hedge. It's a plastic bucket concealed inside a carrier bag. It has a small, very small firework type explosive charge at the bottom, connected to a time switch on the outside. The bucket is filled up with leaflets, and on the top there's some little notices and things designed to warn people away, not to get too near. But it was only live for a few minutes, so they would have had very little time in which to interfere with it. You take it, you set its time to when you want it to go off, you take it to the place where you want it to be, which would be a place crowded with lots of African people up there, usually in the rush hour on their way home, and you just give it a few minutes for your getaway time, and it goes off and it blasts these leaflets high into the air, and it had an electrifying effect on all the people, because it told them that the ANC was still alive and kicking, gave them hope, it brought them messages of what was going on around the world in support of the struggle of the people, and so on.
Sounds a bit like these sort of propaganda leaflet drops that the Americans did over Vietnam,
you could compare it to similar type of thing. Politically, of course, but in another sense you could.
What about the languages? Was it just English it was in, or was it in other languages?
I couldn't tell you. I think I might have been shown one of the leaflets, but I can't say, honestly.
Okay.
The other thing we planted at the same time, to go off at the same time, was a street broadcast, which was a cassette player, and I'd never seen a cassette player before either. It was the latest technology. It had 15 minutes of silence, which was getaway time, and then there was a song, the ANC anthem, Causes Sikaleli Africa, followed by some speeches and some more songs. And this started off with the electrifying words, "This is the African National Congress. This is the African National Congress. This is the voice of freedom." And that's what people heard.
Almost like your version of the kind of "This is the BBC" kind of, you know, well, sort of something else,
you're
but
weird
completely.
Comparisons, but these had a really tremendous effect on the people. They went wild. Yeah. And what I didn't know at the time, because you were only told things on a need-to-know basis, was that this was done in five cities simultaneously, all by people from London, all by white non-South African people sent from London. And in fact, similar actions took place every year from 1967 to 1971. There were other events later on also, but the two things that I did anyway were the 68 and the 1970.
Can you just give us an idea what South Africa was like during that period?
Well, yes. I mean, the oppression and the injustice of that apartheid society was utterly obvious. You couldn't miss it. And it wasn't hidden. That's the thing about it. It was blatant. And you could see it in the body language, the way people talk to each other, the way all the menial jobs went to the black people and all the white people seemed to be in charge of something and so on. It was obvious. Mandela tells a story in his book Long Walk to Freedom, how he was one of the very first lawyers, black lawyers in South Africa, and on his way, when going about his job, a white person could stop him in the street and say, "Would you go across the road and get me some cigarettes, please?" or something, send him off on some errand, because every black person basically just could be co-opted like that to do a job when somebody needed them.
Incredible.
Absolutely humiliating and ridiculous. But you could see it totally, people would offer to do things for me just because they were black and I was white. And it was just that was it. It was very, very unjust, and it was obvious.
Now, recently there's been a book out, hasn't there, about this. What's the title of that, Ken?
Yes, I edited the book, and I compiled it and researched it. It's called London Recruits, The Secret War Against Apartheid. Now, the reason we call it London Recruits is not because all the people in it were Londoners, because they weren't, although many of them were, but Ronnie Kasriel was the ANC official who sent us off on our missions. He published a book in 1993, it had a chapter called London Recruits. He gave it that name, in which he described in a very limited way this episode in which they recruited these white people. His book was called Armed and Dangerous, My Undercover Struggle Against Apartheid. And that had that one chapter called London Recruits. And that's where we got the name for it. And it's an apt name. But it was really the London unit of the ANC, which recruited people from various parts of Britain, including and from Ireland, indeed, and elsewhere.
Were you actually committed to peaceful struggle, or sort of Gandhian type thing? Or, were you shooting people?
I certainly didn't shoot anybody at all. I've described to you what I did. I planted leaflet bombs and I posted letters.
Well, what about Ronnie?
Ronnie, yes, he was involved in the armed struggle. He was head. Later became head of military intelligence for the African National Congress. Yes, he was indeed engaged in armed struggle. And some of our London recruits transported weapons and helped ANC fighters to enter South Africa. They did a whole variety of things besides the little things, the things that I've described that I did. They'd done. And the thing is that everybody kept it secret all their lives. They just moved on, you know, and didn't talk about it for many, many years. Or they told a very few very close family members, but nobody else. And so the story remained untold. And when I reached the age of 60 in 2005, I decided it was time to write the story of what I'd done. And then when I'd done that, I thought myself, well, I know there were others who did similar things. I don't know much about who they were, what they did. I know there were others. I'll try and track them down, get each of them to write their own story, put it in a book, and it'll make a very interesting book. And that's what happened. It's a very interesting book with 32 chapters and all written by different people.
Okay, Ken, we'll talk about the book a little bit more after some music.
Amadou. Rocking.
Oh, mes amis, on choisit pas son destin. Les choses se ressemblent, mais ne sont pas les mêmes. Les droits de la main ne sont pas tous égaux. Dans ce monde, on est complémentaire.
Oh, come on, show me everything that you know. I wanna travel every inch of your curves.
En Afrique, y'a la canicule. Y'a le soleil, la chaleur.
Africa,
Africa, Africa, solidarité,
Africa.
Armandu and Mariam from their album Welcome to Mali, with the song there quite obviously titled Africa. Joining me is Ken Keeble. You better actually spell your name, Ken, because it's if people are interested in getting hold of the book, how do you spell your surname?
K-E-A-B-L-E.
K-E-A-B-L-E. Now, tell us what's in it, because you've obviously got some fascinating stories of these little operations that were done in total secret, but you're only now really, a long time after, 30, 40 years after the event, pulling together what actually happened and finding out some of those individual stories which have been secret for several decades.
Yes, it's quite a unique and amazing book, and incidentally I don't make any money out of it at all, because all the royalties going to a South African charity called the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. So we're not making any money out of it at all. Three of the people in the book are actually being presented with medals this week in South Africa by President Jacob Zuma for their role. These were people who actually were arrested by the regime and tortured. They were based in London, and they suffered greatly for what they'd done. Alex Mumbaris, I think he was on his fifth or sixth mission to South Africa. He and his wife Marie-José, that was her first mission, she was French, they were helping some ANC fighters to enter South Africa by land, and they were arrested, were tortured. Marie-José was pregnant, and there was a big campaign building up in France for her release, and so she was probably too much of an embarrassment to the regime, so they released her after a few months, but she was very badly treated. And Alex was sentenced to, he was also tortured, but he was sentenced to 12 years in prison. But he actually escaped after 7.5 years, along with two white ANC members. The three of them manufactured 14 wooden keys in the prison workshop, replica keys, and they used those to escape after he'd
been in prison. Wooden key? I mean, a wooden key isn't surely not going to do the job that a proper key would do.
Well, I imagine it wears out faster. But these one of the ANC members had been a locksmith, and they knew what they were doing, and they had plenty of time, of course, to make these keys, and that's what they did. They made the keys, and on the night when it was the most favourable time to get out, they got out, and they had smuggled some money into the prison, hailed a taxi, and they got away. Remarkable story. A book has been written about that by Tim Jenkin, one of the two. So that was Alex and Marie-José, and then they were arrested in the spring of 1972. Sean Hosey, who was born in Dublin but brought up mainly in Coventry, I think, he was also a member of the Young Communist League. I knew him. He was in the same branch as me, in fact. And he was arrested in October of 72. He walked into a trap. It was his second mission, and the regime had captured an ANC member and forced him, a black comrade, forced him to send a message requesting some documents and some money. Sean was given the job of bringing this over to him, and he walked straight into a trap. And he had a very bad time. He was 13 months awaiting trial, kept in solitary confinement. And then he did 5 years under the Suppression of Communism Act, and he served that to the day.
The Suppression of Communism Act, can they have that? Because, surely the communism or the communists are at least a legitimate political party. They should at least be allowed to be a political force of communism in any country.
Well, in South Africa they were banned, and any activity associated with the African National Congress was regarded as communism. The government tended to conflate the two. One of the ways in which the government and the regime got some support from the West was on the basis that, of course, it was fighting communism, which it was.
No, I mean, one of the reasons for all this is Britain, isn't it? Because it was originally a British colony. Of course, the Dutch fought for independence from Britain. But, I mean, tell us a little bit about the history of South Africa.
Well, yes, it was, as you say, a British colony, and Britain introduced Britain had legislation in 1909, the South Africa Act 1909, which set up this new thing called the Union of South Africa, and gave it a parliament on a racist basis, and that created the foundation for the apartheid regime.
So are you saying that only white people could vote or something?
No, in the early stages, the so-called Cape Coloured people had a right to vote, but they only had a right to elect people, white people, to represent them. So it was a whites-only parliament. Later on, their right to vote was abolished as well. But at that stage, some of them had a right to elect white people to represent them. But it was a whites-only parliament, and only a whites-only parliament could have enacted the apartheid laws, which came in the 1940s onwards.
Now, I know it was a very rich area in minerals and that sort of thing, and things like... there were. Tell us about some of the characters. I know Cecil Rhodes was famous, as he was even... his name was used to name a country, Rhodesia. Yeah. Tell us about some of those characters who were out there sort of grabbing all these minerals. And, I mean, the thing is, of course, about the mining is that that is still a problem, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's
the extraction of the extraction of those minerals is causing oppression in itself.
Well, yes, it doesn't have to. You can employ people to work without being without oppressing them. But anyway, that's part of the problem. And gold and diamonds and so on. And this was the height of the this is the heyday of the British Empire, really. But the point is that Britain introduced institutional race discrimination into South Africa. That's the point. And the thing that justified all our actions, I believe, is the fact that apartheid was a crime against humanity, and Britain was up to its neck in that crime. That's the point. We weren't interfering in another country. It was nothing to do with us. We were involved anyway. Every British person was implicated in the crime, because all the main British companies had their subsidiaries in South Africa, which operated the apartheid system, discriminated against their staff and customers on a racist basis, and collaborated with the regime and funded it. The City of London was investing heavily in apartheid and profiting from it, from apartheid South Africa, and the British government was giving diplomatic protection to the regime through the UN and so on. So Britain was up to its neck in the crime. So we were all involved anyway, and the fact the British economy was being subsidised by the artificially cheap labour of the South African people. So that's what I think justifies what we did, and every British person was involved on one side or the other, really, though they may not have realised it, of course, at the time.
Can you sum up then some of the feelings that you have now about the time that you did in South Africa, those operations, and the actual what is actually ultimately a success, isn't it? I mean, there's been the overthrowing of that original apartheid regime.
The left has had a lot of failures and non-successes, but this is one of our successes, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
And what lessons do you think there are for today's generations that you've learnt from that?
Well, international solidarity works. International solidarity can indeed be effective. And I think the need for international solidarity is greater now than ever. I think we particularly need to have solidarity with the Palestinian people struggling for their national rights. And once again, Britain is up to its neck in the crime of supporting Zionism and denying the Palestinian people a right to have a country of their own, which they were guaranteed by the United Nations.
Of course, the Foreign Office would say something very different. They would say that they're trying to be balanced about what they're doing in the Middle East and trying to make sure that they are moving both sides towards a peaceful conclusion.
Well, nothing balanced about what the British government is doing at all. No, they're completely reneging on their responsibilities as members of the United Nations.
They're criticising the Israelis this week for introducing what they've said is 3,000 new settlements. So, I mean, they are criticising the Israelis, even if they're not actually sort of closing down embassies or anything like that.
Yes, but Britain, through the European Union, grants a very, very favourable status to Israel for economic purposes. It practically treats Israel as a member of the EU for trading purposes. So it gives it very, very favourable, a great deal of help, economic help. And Britain has very, very recently voted to continue that status, special status, for the relationship of Israel with the EU, despite the fact that it is supposed to be conditional on Israel improving its behaviour. In actual fact, Israel is breaking many, many, many international laws and adopting a policy of genocide, actually, towards the Palestinian people. So I think that's an issue. Still, we're getting away from the South African thing, but no, I think it is very, a comparable struggle, and I think international solidarity is a wonderful thing. I think the book that I've compiled, I mean, I didn't write it, I've just got the stories together. It's a very inspiring story. I hope it will inspire people to take up international solidarity and to fight for a better world. The defeat of the apartheid regime, in which we played a very, very small part, but it was done mainly by the South African people themselves, struck a blow against racism not only in South Africa but all around the world, especially in Britain, which has very close relationships with links with South Africa. And so that's paid us back for what we did. That's paid us back for it. Britain is a less racist society than it was at that time. And I think I think um, so. So I think when you perform an act of international solidarity, you help make Britain a better place, you help to make the world a better place. You don't just help somebody in a distant country to overcome an injustice.
Ken, how did that racist regime manage to carry on? I mean, surely not all the white South Africans were really supporting it, and many of them didn't support it. How did they manage to maintain power with this sort of semblance of democracy when actually what was going on was a hideous racist, almost like a dictatorship?
Well, it was a dictatorship, and most of the whites did support it. There are heroes among them who did not, of course, and who opposed it, but many did. But the thing is, it had the support of the Western powers, of Britain and the United States, and that's very, very important. It couldn't have done it without. I mean, if the City of London had just said, no, we're just going to pull the plug on you because you're wrong, you're immoral, it's racist and we're against it, I mean, they wouldn't have lasted a day. It wouldn't have lasted a day without the trading links.
What about today, though? Do you think there are comparable struggles going on now?
Well, I've mentioned one to you, the Palestinian struggle, yes. But I think there's a worldwide injustice which we've got to tackle in which Britain is involved.
What about with the cuts here in Britain? There are people, you know, now who are getting pretty desperate. Some people have virtually no prospect of getting a job, even though they're just out of university, as more and more people are queuing up for fewer and fewer jobs.
Well, you see, I'm still a communist because the injustices which caused people to become communists many, many years ago are still there in abundance. The same old problems, the irrationality of having poverty and unemployment. I love the statement made by Bob Geldof when he was interviewed some years ago. He said, "It makes no sense for anyone to die of want in a world of plenty." And that sums up so much for me. It makes no sense for anyone to die of want in a world of plenty. Why are people dying of want? And here in Britain, a very, very rich country, extremely... I mean, the 1,000 richest people in the UK have got a combined wealth of over £400 billion. We haven't got a problem of lack of money in this country. It's just in the wrong hands. It's not being used for the right purposes.
Ken, just remind us finally then of your book title and where we can get it.
Yes, well, you can get it from any bookshops or online sources. It's called London Recruits... Secret War Against Apartheid.
Ken Keeble, thanks very much.
Thank you.
L'hypocrisie dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Démagogie dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. La dictature dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Du bonheur dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Démagogie
dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas. Les dictateurs dans la politique. Ce n'est pas bon, ce n'est pas bon, nous n'en voulons pas.
Amando and Miriam again with Ce n'est pas bon. And now I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
All right, now, you're going to say something now, I think, about the Black Triangle campaign. What is that?
Black Triangle campaign is a campaign against the current almost tax on the disabled population by the current Conservative Democratic government. Of the United Kingdom. Black Triangle Group gets its name from the Black Triangles worn by disabled and invalid people in Nazi Germany in the concentration camps. So, yeah.
So what are the Black Triangle people actually up to?
Well, the main purpose is to oppose the current cuts to disability benefits and also to help out anyone who have failed appeals on their ATOS tests.
Oh, these are these assessments. Can you just give us an idea of what disabled people are having to go through as part of these assessments?
Well, what they're having to go through at the moment is having to go through a series of quite demeaning questions where they're judged as either whether or not they're actually able of working, and in some cases people who have for a long time been considered unable to work have been considered able to work, and some of these cases have included a man who was in a coma.
Right. Well, yes, demeaning certainly in that case, but I mean, surely it's quite right for the government, for the Department of Social Security, to every now and again to review the benefits that it's paying out and review the people that it's paying them to actually assess whether they really need that money. Surely, you know, that's just a normal part of, you know, is there anything different about these ATOS assessments?
Well, the difference about the ATOS assessments is, first of all, it's going through a private company based in France, so not an English company, but the main issue is that they're asking some very daft questions of people, and also not only that, but they're sort of testing every 6 months, so even somebody with a lifelong disability has to be reassessed every 6 months just in case their status changed. Somebody who's born blind has to be reassessed just in case by some miracle they're now able to see.
Okay, so it's an increased frequency. Also, there's one other aspect to this which is a bit awkward, and that is that a lot of people are having to appeal. Why is that?
A lot of people are having to appeal because in the past they've been entitled to the right because they really have a serious condition, and yet now they've been judged as not being disabled. Now, these conditions can be anything from physical conditions to something like severely diabetic or something like severely dyspraxic or severely autistic, and yet because they're technically able-bodied, they've been judged as able to work. And this is the main problem, because where do you draw the line?
Well, good question indeed. And the Black Triangle campaign can be found online at Black Triangle, one word. Sorry, no, actually it's three words, isn't it? Black Triangle campaign, three words, all run into one. BlackTriangleCampaign.org. It's the disabled people fighting for our future, custodians of our past. And there's a tremendous amount of advice, including legal advice and this kind of thing about people who don't believe that they should be reassessed, and what to do if you think that the ATOS assessment is incorrect. So lots of advice on there. That's blacktrianglecampaign.org. Thanks very much, Jason.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Now I'm joined by Olivia Griffiths. Hi, Olivia.
Hello.
Now, could you... you're going to tell us a little bit about Kindles. Can you do that?
Yes, of course I can. So, last year, Amazon announced that online Kindle sales had overtaken sales of their paper and hardback books. With increasing sales of tablets and Kindle, is the printing press in jeopardy? I'll be looking at advantages and disadvantages of virtual books and newspapers as well against the so-called old-fashioned physical media. Each format has something to offer, but is it better to buy our reading material online so it's downloadable straight to a tablet or Kindle, or go to the bookshop down the road and support local businesses? I find loads of reports announcing the decline of independent bookshops. So the first potential drawback is of printed books is the price. That's what lots of people seem to be saying. Printed books are much higher priced than downloadable ebooks, which means that obviously more people prefer to use those and not waste money. However, large publishers, like any business, have a significant amount of overhead, including office space, utilities and salaries. When they take on a new author, they're never guaranteed that the work generated by the author will be successful, and they're taking on an enormous risk by signing an author. So all of these factors go into the final price that readers pay for a print book, including printing, editing and distribution. But according to publishers, printing a book actually only accounts for about 8% of the total cost of the book. So the price isn't lowered just because there's no printing press involved, which I find quite interesting, because I thought that it was the actual printing process that made a printed book more expensive. So suppliers of ebooks still have the costs of employees, editors, graphic designers, etc., and of course the people who create the ebook. So with the exception of ink, printing and shipping, costs are pretty much the same as traditional print books.
Now, what about yourself? Have you got a Kindle?
I do have a Kindle. My sister's got a tablet. And I have to say, I do love it.
You prefer your Kindle, do you?
I prefer my Kindle to the tablet.
Why is that, though? Tablets are bigger, isn't it?
Tablet's a bit bigger, and I find I get distracted on a tablet if it's got the internet, or find myself on Facebook.
You stop reading your book and do something else.
Yeah.
What about you, Jason? Do you use any of these high-tech devices?
I don't actually. I just pretty much use my laptop for most things. I was considering, my father has a Kindle because my father reads mass amounts of books. So I was considering getting Kindle actually, because I also like to read a lot. It's actually pretty much what I do most days at the moment.
Yeah, I mean it is. It's certainly moving away from the whole idea of having sort of bookshops and physical books. Then they are also cheaper, aren't they, to buy?
Yeah.
The other thing, I don't know if you managed to look at this, is that some of the Kindles have got a wireless connection with them, haven't they?
Yeah. No, I've got one with a wireless.
So how does that work? I mean, why does the Kindle need to be, or what's the benefit of having it actually sort of picking up various wireless networks? Is it wireless or possibly...
It's 3G as well.
Right, okay, so it's like hooked into the mobile phone network. What does it... Yeah. Why is it hooked in?
So basically, I think you can... Everyone loves going into a bookshop and browsing. And apparently, this was only for 1 week or a very, very short period of time, Amazon actually paid people to, if they went into a bookshop, they pay people to use their Kindle instead of buying it from the bookshop. So you can stand in a bookshop whip your Kindle out and buy the book for quarter of the price.
Okay, so it's sort of discounted book whilst you're in the actual bookshop.
Yeah.
Whilst you're in the bookshop, you can help get rid of bookshops.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's terrible.
But actually, I on the other hand, I did find other reports kind of dissuading us from supporting local bookshops and claiming that e-books are better for authors, the economy, and the reader. Obviously, they're cheaper for the reader. Don't use paper.
I can tell you don't like these Kindles, Jason. But the thing is, this is technology, isn't it? And it's moving on. The other thing, of course, about these, the wireless network, you can actually be downloading your book on that wireless network. You don't need to sort of plug in anything or whatever. And I know a friend of mine that's got a Kindle, you can do email. And part of the buying of his Kindle was some sort of very long-term, over several years, subscription to the wireless network, so he can do his email on his Kindle. Absolutely revolutionary technology, but whether it's good or bad, I think it'll probably take us 10 or 20 years to figure that one out. Anyway, both of you, that's Jason Yiannakopoulos and Olivia Griffiths. Thanks very much for that little technological update. That's now, funny. US filmmaker Alan Frankovich made the definitive film for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing called The Maltese Double Cross, which suggests there was a secret motive for the US to blow up that Pan Am flight. He also made the three-part Operation Gladio film for the BBC Time Watch series, which was released to stunned audiences in 1992. That documented NATO blowing up European civilians and blaming it on the Russians, the Red Brigades, the Baader-Meinhof gang, and even the IRA. Frankovich died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport Customs Hall in 1994. Alongside the feature films of Greek-born French filmmaker Costa Gavras, Frankovich's 1970s and 1980s documentary give us a deep insight into the criminal side of Western intelligence services such as MI6, the CIA, the Israeli Mossad, and NATO intelligence. All these secret political operations being deniable, but carried out under secret orders of prime ministers, presidents, and royalty. Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative Views in Austin, Texas, just after he released In Company Business, his film all about the CIA. He described the CIA as a kind of Rotary Club version of the Nazis' hated secret police, the Gestapo.
The CIA's been on company business for years, so what's been its job in France, Italy, Guatemala, Iran, Cuba, and the Congo? And what does Colby know, and Agee, Jackson, Braden, Nixon, Marchetti, Helms, Bundy, Stockwell, Church? And what about Truman, Ike, Kennedy? The CIA's been on company business in stealth. Now, we find out.
On Company Business has won awards and has been shown in over 35 countries around the world. Alan Frankovich, its producer and director, is with us tonight to tell us his story.
Our guest tonight is Alan Frankovich, who's the filmmaker who made the award-winning documentary On Company Business. That's a three-hour documentary giving the history of and exposing some of the operations of the infamous CIA. To begin, would you like to give some background about what led you to make the film in the first place, to take on the CIA?
Well, this was a film which was 5 years in production, and I started working on it in 1974, 1975. And it was apparent to me at that moment, and you have to remember that in 1975 the CIA was under investigation or on the verge of being investigated, that nobody was going to really go into the CIA and arrive at the conclusions that I thought one had to arrive at, because of the collusion between the CIA and all institutions of the American establishment. But on the other hand, there a lot of people were starting to talk for the first time about things which had been done in secret over long periods of time. And I was able, therefore, to interview a whole series of people at every level of the CIA, from directors down to secretaries and accountants, and then spend a great deal of time actually researching coverage of events. Sometimes this involves CIA-created propaganda, which they inserted into the world media, and other times it involved contrasting what we were being told was happening in some country, and then contrasting that with the CIA operatives telling you what they were really doing, and that this was official United States policy, except it was conducted secretly so that we, the citizens of this country, would never know about it.
Why did you decide that this was the time to make a film about the CIA. What did you think needed to be told to the American people about the CIA, and what was your goal in making that film?
Well, really, I think the main point really is that this country has had a secret foreign policy ever since the end of the Second World War. And one of the essential instruments has been the Central Intelligence Agency. In other words, we've had presidents, every president since Truman has made great moral pronouncements. But the CIA has been the instrument they have used, actually, too consistently, and in every part of the world. This is interesting. It's not only in third world countries. The first CIA operations were in Europe. And you have the United States government making great moral pronouncements and statements while it's using this instrument to penetrate, infiltrate, and destroy anything which gets in the way of what they define as the interest of the United States. And if you look at the historical record and you look at the countries the film goes into, you find that, for instance, the operations they conduct, they haven't bothered asking us if we felt threatened by this, that, or the other thing. And often their economic interests that they're defending, as a matter of fact, I would say almost always, and in some cases the same entities that in this country don't care whether an American worker has a job or not, are doing everything they can to destroy the capability of anybody in these other countries controlling their own destiny.
I think your film documents very well the infiltration and manipulation of trade unions in the third world, where they support the right-wing trade movements to try to keep these countries from forming more radical trade union movements. So you intended just simply to tell the story of the CIA from the end of World War II to the present day, to give a history of it and tell the people the truth, or what you perceived as the truth, about the CIA that the media had covered over?
Well, the thing was really to get people in the CIA who were talking for the first time to sit them down, have them tell the audience what they did, and to show consistently over a 30-year period of time that there were certain methods which were used and they had nothing to do with national security, essentially. They had a lot to do with justifying these operations, whether they're against Chile or Guatemala or Angola or in European context. They had a lot to do with intervening in the internal affairs of a whole series of countries to force them to comply with what presidents of the United States wanted these countries to do. And these kinds of activities are not something which just happened in moments of crisis. They go on every day in every country of the world. And they're the official but secret foreign policy of this country. And they're done specifically on presidential orders. And what will happen in 1974 and 1975, and I believe it happened primarily because one of the political parties, in the form of Richard Nixon, started using the same agency inside this country not against dissidents, mind you, because I think against a major political party. And therefore, when that starts happening, you have to tell your guys, look, this far, no further. And you start investigating them, you have to make a real investigation, because they know all kinds of secrets, they know where all the bodies are buried, and therefore, to rein them in, you have to investigate them. But the conclusions, I knew in 1974, 75, they would never conclude that these were official government operations, that American presidents had ordered them, because the very nature of the CIA is to conduct these operations in secret, in such a way that if the CIA is caught, they take the responsibility themselves, and the president of the United States is protected.
Is that why they said that the CIA was a rogue elephant out of
control? Exactly, that was the conclusion. And if you look, for instance, you look at the CIA, the assassinations the CIA claims they planned but never executed, you will find in the several cases the Church Committee went into, the Lumumba assassination, the assassination of the commander-in-chief of the Chilean army, that a few days before these people are bumped off, a cable will go out saying, don't do it, guys, and nevertheless it goes ahead. And this is, again, standard CIA operating procedure. These operations are done to preserve the cover, and so that the United States then can take a moral position while eliminating someone that they consider to be an obstacle to what they want to accomplish.
So, Alan, it seems kind of contradictory that the CIA is secret, the people are secret, and yet in your documentary you have interviews with all of these high CIA officials and you were able to talk to so many people. Why is this?
Because the CIA, they have a kind of false openness. You see, a lot of what they do, for instance, in overseas posts, is they talk to the press, they manipulate the press. I would say that if you took a percentage of their operations, you would find that a great percentage-wise really have to deal with getting out their line through the media. Because if they accomplish that, in a sense, they control the way you see a situation. They control the way you think about a situation. So they have an ability, really, and they feel very much at ease with press and media. And they have, God knows, the number of books which have been written by former CIA people to take a pro-CIA position. And it's only recently that there are some people like John Stockwell, Philip Agee, and a couple of other people who have really decided, well, if the pro-CIA people are writing books, why don't we write books? But we'll really go into the nature of some of these operations.
So a lot of these people who are CIA operatives that you interviewed thought they were using you and manipulating you to get their point of view across. Wasn't there a point that they found out that this guy Frankovic may be doing a hatchet job on us? And at that time, did you get any less cooperation from the CIA, or worse, did you
I don't think they really paid much attention to what I was doing. You see, because it was, I think at the moment when they realized that this film was on a scale that they had not even imagined, because you see, you're dealing with 5 years of your life. You're dealing with a research effort where I researched for film, background film, in just about every film library in the world. I did a range of interviews of 50 to 60 to 80 people. On the other hand, you have to realize that, for instance, one of the persons interviewed in the film is a former president of CBS News, the founding president of CBS News and Public Affairs. And he says that when he became president of CBS News, they had a relationship with the CIA. He had inherited this relationship, and it involved providing cover to CIA representatives. But it also involved, and this is incredible, providing any material they had in their news library to the CIA. For instance, the CIA wanted to identify somebody in a country who was leading a demonstration. So you're dealing with a level of collusion, and you're dealing with the fact that there is a level of contact at the top level of the networks, and they're reaching 50 million people a night. So what the CIA is concerned about, they're not concerned about a little book or a little newspaper article in The Nation. They're concerned about things which really tell you the truth about what they're doing, and in this case, in CIA on company business, it's entirely told you by people in the agency, and then reaching a large number of people. Because the very reason they keep their operations secret is because if they try to explain them to us, they would find very little to justify them. And since this country is still a democracy, we're still allowed to vote, and God knows how long that's going to continue, it's going to be... They have to do these things in secret. In other words, they're keeping them not so much from the other countries, because I'm sure, for instance, in the case of Chile, that the government of Chile knew the CIA was trying to destroy their government. They're trying to keep them from us. And that's why they are very upset with some of the people who wrote books which were much more forthcoming than they would like to be. And that's why this film, because it has reached a very large audience, is of concern to them now. But when it was being made, I don't think they really cared.
That was US filmmaker Alan Frankovic speaking to the Austin, Texas VHS video news magazine Alternative Views way back in 1982. And we'll have more of that next week. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733. They have hundreds of volunteering opportunities at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So until the same time next week, goodbye.
Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, not for sale. So the budget of the PCTs, he wants a hand to the GPs, oh please. Don't geeks are gonna buy from any willing provider and get care from private companies. So the pie and the one apiece, got the rise on the peas like mice for the cheese. Told truth when I ride the beat, you talk shy when you speak. See money when you close your eyes to sleep. So fall back, your face looks like a shriveled up bull sack. The stuff that you say is bullcrap, I'm sure Andy Pandy snores crack. Health minister, I mean sinister, you know the public will finish ya. Is your brain really that miniature? You're full of crap, give yourself an enema. You're filthy rich from those who represent Walker's Chris. Mars and pizza hot proved you're a health slut, and you're always talking shit. £134 an hour, every week that's quite a lot of quids. And you came to the conclusion the food industry should be a little less strict. Scandal disclosed that you flipped your second home. You said your claims were within the rules, filled your pockets, took us for jokes. How would you cope when broke folk get ill, injured and broke, but they don't have the dough to get their life back on the road, so the poor die slow and the rich take control. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, not for sale. Lansley's white paper liberating the NHS sets out a plan where we'll become more like the US, and care will be farmed out to private companies who will sell their service to the NHS via GPs, who will have more to do with their service purchase arrangements than anything to do with even seeing their patients. He's been given cash by Johnny Nash, chairman of Care UK, a private healthcare provider who, if they have their own way, will be the biggest beneficiaries of Conservative Lib Dem policies to privatise healthcare, pull apart their welfare state. These plans have been slacked by patient organisations, charities, unions, nursing and medical institutions. The Royal College of GPs even joined the attack, looked closely at the proposals and said they were crap. So say yes for the NHS, Andrew Lansley could suck at David Cameron's breast. He's pressing for the rich to pay less and the poor have to stress, it'll be one big mess. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, you grey-haired manky codger. Andrew Lansley, greedy Andrew Lansley, tosser. The NHS is not for sale, not for sale.